I'm Jerry Krantman, and this is American Dream Radio. The U.S. middle class is in a downward economic spiral and has been for 30 years. Politicians rely on campaign funds from large corporate donors. Large corporations rely on favorable treatment from politicians they support. Mass media seems to be all corporate news propaganda, and it doesn't seem like most people even know that yet. Even if a person wanted to do something about it, what can anyone do? The choices for activism are seeming to get more limited and more disheartening. It's not easy for people who want to improve the situation to find new ways to do that. Think globally, act locally, says the activist's adage, and it's good advice. Unquestionably, local actions are the backbone of activism, and effective local actions can put global principles into practice. With the advent of globalization, though, some needed political changes might require cooperation across national boundaries. Organizations like the World Trade Organization, or WTO, have made the world safe for big business, but how has that affected working people in those countries? And how can those people in a small country or a large one wield any real influence over the international forces of business? With the advent of the Internet, some local activists have found ways to act globally, too, right from wherever they are. Today we present a voice for systemic change across national boundaries, a voice that is coming from somewhere that may surprise you. We're speaking today with Dr. Granwith Hulitberry, Senior Spokesperson for the WTO. Dr. Hulitberry, welcome to American Dream Radio.
Thank you very much.
Doctor, quite frankly, I was surprised when you agreed to my request for an interview. I assume you and the WTO know that American Dream Radio has a reputation for questioning some of the WTO's actions. I must say, though, that I'm very pleased that the WTO has not only agreed to have you speak, but has provided such a high-level spokesperson for our discussion. Can you tell me something about how it was decided for you to be here today?
We've consented to give this interview because we've decided to disband the World Trade Organization as it currently exists, which I think will delight a number of your listeners.
I expect so.
Until the present, of course, the World Trade Organization has essentially been a tool to help businesses do business regardless of any other consideration. And as human beings, of course, we at the WTO care a great deal about people in general. It's just that the charter of our organization is to help business only, in other words, the wealthy. And we have decided to disband the organization and refound it with a completely different charter based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So from now on, the World Trade Organization, well, as soon as we finish this transformation, will make sure that trade benefits all people, not just the wealthy.
Well, I can imagine that there are a lot of listeners who will be rather excited to hear that news.
Yes.
If only it were true. American Dream Radio is now proud to count itself, along with the distinguished BBC, among an elite group of broadcasters to have been conned by the increasingly recognized Yes Men. We're speaking today with Andy Bichlbaum, one of the famous or infamous, depending on which circles you travel in, Yes Men, on the phone today from Paris, France.
Foiled again.
Welcome to American Dream Radio, Andy Bichlbaum.
Thank you.
Andy, I'm wondering why you are called the Yes Men.
Well, Yes Men are, you know, those who agree with the boss regardless of the content of what the boss says. And that's effectively what we do. We basically adopt the positions of those that we're targeting and amplify them. So we basically say them at twice the volume they're usually set at, and hope that who we're saying them to notices that there's something wrong, in a word.
Right. Now, I know that you haven't always found that to be the case, that people notice that there's something wrong.
Right.
Wondering how many yes men there are. I read about two. Is that the actual number of yes men?
No, there's a lot more. There, every action that we've done, we've depended a lot on a lot of different people for research into the subjects that we've tackled, into for housing in the places that we've gone, because we don't have very much money, for assistance with travel and all sorts of things. So it's really for graphics help. We're not very good at designing things graphically, so and for writing press releases, people help us with that. So it's a much larger group, really. It's just we're the two who tend to go on the excursions.
Well, the Yes Men started out a number of years ago, is that correct?
Yeah.
From the early days of switching the voice boxes between Barbies and G.I. Joe dolls and putting them back on the shelf for shoppers and the media to discover later.
Well, that was long before we were the Yes Men. We did a bunch of projects, the two of us, Mike and I, together for a number of years, and then the way the whole series of Yes Men things happened was quite by accident. It was right before the protests against the WTO in Seattle in November of 1999. We couldn't actually attend. So we did the next best thing, or maybe the fifth best thing after that, and set up a satirical website at GATT.org, G-A-T-T.org, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was the predecessor of the WTO, so it was an appropriate address, and the site looked fairly similar to the WTO site, but it was entirely critical of it and satirical. And we thought no more about it, until and this was basically to act as a commentary on the WTO, to participate in the protest process, if only virtually. And we thought no more about it until we got an invitation to attend a conference in about 4 months later. And this little legal conference in Austria wanted a speaker from the WTO to come. Actually, they wanted the director general of the WTO, but he couldn't make it. Another representative could. It took us about 2 months to answer that mail, by the way, before we realized, oh, yeah, we could just do this. So it happened entirely by accident that we ended up impersonating, or representing, rather, these institutions.
So the confusingly similar websites was on purpose, but you didn't ever imagine it would lead to actually flying around the world speaking at conferences?
No, not ever. It's the kind of thing that we've encountered again and again. You just, accidents happen, and you got to jump on them.
Well, you know, the most recent event that's been in the news, although I would love to talk with you about some of your others, but your website, DowEthics.com, it appears that people who were looking for Dow Chemical, and I was one of them, I did a search for Dow and Ethics, and on Google that was the number one hit, and on Yahoo it was the number one hit. And I saw that when I searched for Dow Chemical, your Dow Ethics site was like number four, but I think it only just became number four because number three is now the Yes Men in Dow Chemical.
Oh. That's a giveaway.
So probably you used to be, there was Dow Chemical, and then there was some fairly technical reference to Dow Chemical, and then there was your site, which to all appearances was another Dow Chemical site. And looking at the site, they were identical.
Yeah, they're pretty similar, yeah. I mean,
the text
is all different, of course.
Of course. The pictures are the same.
The pictures are the same. It's easier that way.
Why don't you tell us a little about what happened on the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster?
Sure, yeah. It was quite by accident, as most of the things that we do are. We received an email at this DowEthics.com website from a researcher at the BBC who wanted to know if Dow would send somebody to come speak on TV about the Bhopal catastrophe. And Dow just doesn't do that, usually. But in this case, they were very happy to. We said we would. We wished it had been Fox or CBS or ABC or NBC that had approached us instead of the BBC, since the BBC was already doing a really good job of covering Bhopal. But the American networks just pay absolutely no attention to the anniversary. In fact, a lot of years, the anniversary of Bhopal goes completely unnoticed in the media, not a single article of any importance. And, you know, this was the Bhopal catastrophe was the biggest industrial accident of all time, and a really still an egregious situation. I mean, people are still dying there, and you know, children are still playing on the plant site, which has never been cleaned up. People are still getting well water from just above the site, and an estimated one person per day is still dying from illnesses contracted because of the toxicity that, again, was never cleaned up. So when activists are talking about Bhopal, they're talking about trying to pressure Dow to actually do something about it, like clean up the site, for example, and compensate the victims more than the $500 that they've been compensated, at most, $500. And that's more in India than it is, say, in the United States, but it's only enough to pay for a year of medical care, even so. And most of these victims are going to need at least, many years. Many of them a lifetime. An estimated 120,000 will need a lifetime of medical care. So.
But Dow Chemical, who purchased Union Carbide, I guess, has decided to stonewall as a tactic.
When they purchased Union Carbide, they did settle many of Union Carbide's liabilities in the United States, but they've refused to do anything about their liabilities in India, simply because I suppose Indians will never be, the Bhopalis in any case, will never be Dow shareholders. So when we got this invitation, we thought, well, here's a way to get this into the U.S. media. And we had basically two options. One was to represent Dow as it really is, but a little more grotesquely, or much more grotesquely perhaps, or much more clumsily, let's say.
Which is something you've done in other settings before with WTO and other organizations, yes.
Yeah, we've done that a number of times. We even did it on TV once on CNBC Market Wrap, represented the WTO very brutally, honestly, and nobody seemed to notice. The producer of the show sent us a tape. We didn't get any feedback from any viewers. It went completely unnoticed.
Huh.
And since the goal of this was to actually get it in the media, we decided to do the something that we felt sure would get a lot of notice, and that would force Dow to react. And that was simply to have Dow do the right thing so that they would have to either later do the right thing themselves, you know, say, okay, yeah, we're doing that, or say, no, we're not doing the right thing. We're definitely not going to help these people out that we could help out so easily.
Either way, they're in the news.
Right. And that was the goal. We didn't intend the retraction from Dow to take 2 hours to arrive. We thought it would be immediate. We even thought that I might be cut off while on the air, but none of that happened.
But you got to do your whole bit until it was debunked a little later. Unfortunately, as you said, the Indian press, of course, developed some false hopes for the people in Bhopal who thought maybe something wonderful had happened, only to be disappointed.
Right.
But it got it probably more press than that 20th anniversary would have had in any case.
Oh, much more, yeah.
This is American Dream Radio. We're about 15 minutes into a 48-minute interview with Andy Bickelbaum, recorded on December 13, 2004. Andy is one of a group of political activists called the Yes Men. Their goal? To change the world one prank at a time. Dow Chemical had purchased Union Carbide 3 years before and maintains that it has no responsibility for the 1984 disaster in Bhopal, India, when tons of deadly gases leaked from a Union Carbide pesticide factory. 7,000 people died within the first few days, and 15,000 more in the years since. 100,000 others are still suffering chronic, debilitating illnesses from what was one of the worst industrial disasters in history. On the 20th anniversary of the event, Dow would have been silent but for the Yes Men's hoax. Here's the BBC broadcast of December 3rd, 2004.
Well, joining us live from Paris now is Jude Finisterre. He's a spokesman for Dow Chemicals, which took over Union Carbide. Good morning to you. A day of commemoration in Bhopal. Do you now accept responsibility for what happened?
Steve, yes. Today is a great day for all of us at Dow, and I think for millions of people around the world as well. It's 20 years since the disaster, and today I'm very, very happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. We have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the 120,000 who may need medical care for their entire lives, and to fully and swiftly remediate the Bhopal plant site. Now, when we acquired Union Carbide 3 years ago, we knew what we were getting, and it's worth $12 billion. $12 billion. We have resolved to liquidate Union Carbide, this nightmare for the world and this headache for Dow, and use the $12 billion to provide more than $500 per victim, which is all that they've seen, a maximum of just about $500 per victim. It is not plenty good for an Indian, as one of our spokespersons unfortunately said a couple of years ago. In fact, it pays for 1 year of medical care. We will adequately compensate the victims. Furthermore, we will perform a full and complete remediation of the Bhopal site, which, as you mentioned, has not been cleaned up. When Union Carbide abandoned the site 20 years ago, or 16 years ago, they left tons of toxic waste, which continues. The site continues to be used as a playground by children. Water continues to be drunk from the groundwater underneath. It's a mess, Steve. And
it's a mess, certainly, Jude. That's good news that you have finally accepted responsibility. Some people would say too late. It's 3 years, yes. Almost 4 years on. How soon is your money going to make a difference to the people in Bhopal?
Well, as soon as we can get it to them, Steve. We've begun the process of liquidating Union Carbide. This is, as you mentioned, late, but it's the only thing we can do. When we acquired Union Carbide, we did settle their liabilities in the United States immediately. And we are now, 3 years later, prepared to do the same in India. We should have done it 3 years ago. We are doing it now. I would say that it's better late than never. And I would also like to say that this is no small matter, Steve. This is the first time in history that a publicly owned company of anything near the size of Dow has performed an action which is significantly against its bottom line simply because it's the right thing to do. And our shareholders may take a bit of a hit, Steve, but I think that if they're anything like me, they will be ecstatic to be part of such a historic occasion of doing right by those that we've wronged.
And does this mean you will also cooperate in any future legal actions in India or the USA?
Absolutely, Steve. One of our non-financial commitments is to press the United States government to finally extradite Warren Anderson, who fled India after being arrested in 1984. He posted $2,000 bail on multiple homicide charges and fled India promptly. We are going to press the United States government to extradite Mr. Anderson, who's living in Long Island, to India to finally face the charges, and I believe they may be lenient. we're also going to engage in unprecedented transparency. We're going to release, finally, the full composition of the chemicals and the studies that were performed by Union Carbide shortly after the catastrophe. This information has never been released, Steve, and it's time for it to be released in case any of that information can be of use to medical professionals. And finally, we're going to perform we're going to fund research. Any interested researcher can contact Dow's Ethics and Compliance Office. We are going to fund with no strings attached research into the safety of any Dow product whose safety many competent scientists have raised significant doubts about many Dow products, and we do not want to be a company that sells products that may have long-term negative effects on the world. This is a momentous occasion, and our new CEO, Andrew Lavaris, who's been our CEO for just a month, less than a month, has decided to take Dow in this unprecedented direction.
Jude, we will leave it there. Thank you for joining us. Just to reiterate what Jude Finisterra, the spokesman for Dow Chemicals, has just said. He says Dow Chemicals now fully accept responsibility for the events in Bhopal 20 years ago, and they will cooperate in future legal action.
Then you started issuing denials, too. I mean, that was actually as fun, I think, as the original thing. Not denials that the yes men weren't part of it, but rather denials from Dow about the incident, restating all the salient facts again, naming all the things that Dow still won't take responsibility for and or assist with.
Yeah, we had a good time writing that. We wrote it originally as a press release from Dow about all the things that we would do, but then when it became clear that the story was not being... was actually going a lot further than we thought of its own volition, we decided to just turn it into a debunking of a disavowal of our own action that way, because Dow was really not saying anything. Dow was just saying that was not a real Dow representative, and they weren't saying what their actual position was. They were avoiding the subject, so we thought, well, we'll do some public relations work for them and actually explain exactly what they're saying when they're saying that they're not going to, that this person was not really their representative. What they really mean is they're not going to actually take responsibility. They're not going to clean up the site. They're not going to do this and that.
So you made sure to elucidate or enumerate all of those things.
Right.
Now, was Maria Ashinen one of yours or one of Dow's?
I believe she's one of Dow's, okay. And she's made up by Dow. We didn't make her up.
Okay, well, it was a funny name, and I wasn't sure whether it was one of your denials or one of Dow's denials.
You know, truth is often better than fiction.
And then Dow's president, Michael Parker, he was fired. That was before your incident, was it not? Or
yeah, that was a month ago. Yeah, they've got a new president, somebody, Lavaris. So, of course, this was his first move. Only a month in, he decided to take Dow in a radically different direction. And on the BBC broadcast, we made sure to mention that this was effectively impossible, that this was the first time in history that a company anything like Dow had chosen to do the right thing simply because it was the right thing, and even and against its profitability. And you know, part of the idea of this was to point out the flaw, the impossibility of the so-called corporate social responsibility. It's a nonsense concept. It can't exist. I mean, corporations can be forced to do things, or they can be allowed to do anything they want. If they're allowed to do anything they want, they're just going to worry about their bottom line, and that's all. In the United States, even CEOs can be sued by shareholders if they do anything against the bottom line, mm-hmm. whether it's morally right or not. So the whole concept is absurd.
I want to talk maybe for a minute about some of your other hoaxes. This wasn't the only such thing that you folks did.
Right,
and some of them are pretty amazing and also pretty disturbing in some ways. And I wonder if maybe you can tell us about a couple of your other appearances and what's happened.
Sure, yeah. For a number of years, for 3 years, we went around impersonating the World Trade Organization. We kept getting invitations at our website, GATT.org, that looked a lot like the World Trade Organization website. And the invitations were for various sorts of conferences around the world, and once even for a TV program, CNBC Market Wrap. And each time we agreed, and each time we came up with a more absurd speech and performance than the last time, culminating, I guess the most absurd performance we did was in Finland, where we talked about how essentially modern sweatshop labor was simply an improved version of slavery. You know, you didn't have to transport the slaves anywhere. You could pay. You could feed them for less than it would cost here. And finally, at the height of this grotesque speech, I inflated a 3-foot phallus. My business suit was ripped off. It was a suit that could rip off, special Velcro seam down the back, and this giant 3-foot phallus inflated, and I explained to the audience that this phallus was a device to control distant workers so that the manager could walk around with hands free, could go enjoy himself at the beach, and simultaneously watch his employees and administer electric shocks through a little panel on the top of the phallus.
So surely this brought a big laugh, and everybody said, oh, obviously this man is a phony. He's just torn off a breakaway suit and shown us a phallus.
They never thought I was a phony. They thought it was a real speech by the WTO, and in fact, I spent the day at the conference. We all did. We spent a day just walking around talking to people at the conference, and had dinner with at the president's table. It was all very very weird.
So finally, nobody even caught on, even after this.
No, not even after that. The moderator of the day of the event thanked the WTO 3 times publicly for this very interesting presentation. There were actually no questions from the audience afterwards. And I prodded people to see, not literally prodded, verbally prodded people to during the day at various at lunch and at dinner to see if anybody had minded any of the talk about slavery or whatnot, and nobody had.
So all your talk about tightening the screws on workers and making it harder for third world countries didn't seem to upset anybody.
No, it didn't seem to get any reaction at all. So the next speech after the Finland speech was we got an invitation to a conference in Australia, and we decided to try it out on some students. So we prepared this elaborate lecture, which was even grosser and weirder than the one in Finland. And it involved a solution to third world hunger that was entirely within the market logic. And that involved having third worlders eat their food again and again, recycle their food. In other words, eat their own shit. And at the beginning of the lecture, we passed out hamburgers and then told the students that these were recycled hamburgers. But before we could get to that part, actually, after about 5 minutes of me just talking abstractly about the market and the WTO and how we had to enable the WTO to do anything regardless of people's will, or how we had to allow corporations to do anything regardless of what governments might want or people might want, the students were up in arms and very angry. So we decided that the problem really was not so much that we weren't going far enough with our parody. It was rather that the people that we'd been addressing, these experts like the experts in Finland and the lawyers in Austria and so on, were simply too attuned to the philosophy of the WTO and to the ideas of corporate freedom to notice. I mean, they were simply, what we were saying was simply a particular version of what they heard all the time. So it wasn't. It
they knew what to
them.
Expect from you, and as long as you said that, that was fine.
Right.
But then you tried going, a thing perhaps similar to the Tao experience, where
right.
you went the other way with it. This is American Dream Radio. We're about 30 minutes into a 48-minute interview with Andy Bickelbaum, one of the Yes Men, a group of political activists who are changing the world one prank at a time. This interview was recorded on December 13th, 2004. Tell us about that and what happened there.
Yeah,
too.
Well, finally, for the conference in Australia, we decided to just do something completely different and announce, as the WTO, that we, the WTO, were disbanding because we'd seen all the negative effects of unfettered corporate freedom and had decided to re-found the WTO as a much more humane organization devoted to making sure that trade would benefit all people and not just wealthy people. Because right now, of course, the basic DNA of the WTO is to help business. It says as much on its website. That's the founding principle of the WTO. It's to help business do business. It's nothing about helping people rise out of poverty. It's nothing about helping people eat. It's simply help business do business.
So you were there as Kenneth Rung Spratt, and
right.
Whose email address was spratt@get, of course. And after talking for almost an hour with these kinds of actual statistics and talking about what you were going to do with the WTO to these experts,
mm-hmm.
who, as we have said, tend to go along with the usual talk about it, they must have been up in arms about the WTO disbanding and doing things for poor people.
No, they were thrilled, actually. They were completely thrilled. And in a way that was really sincere and very creative, actually. They actually had a lot of ideas about how the WTO could ensure that it would help poor people and that it wouldn't get caught up again in just serving the interests of the wealthy. And these were accountants. These weren't radical students or anything else. These were stodgy accountants. But like any person, like any human being, they cared and they understood that the ideas of unfettered free trade are absurd and damaging. It just had to be they had to be given a license to express themselves, and they did. So they suggested all kinds of ideas, like locating the headquarters of the WTO in a third world country so that even the poorest members could afford to have a presence at meetings. Currently, there's something like 20 or 30 countries that can't afford to have office space in Geneva, which of course means that they don't get to participate in decisions that affect them. In any case, the accountants were thrilled, and that was a great way to end our whole WTO experience.
Yeah, it almost gives you the idea that whichever way the WTO wanted to lead, that people might be willing to follow, huh?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, when we disbanded the WTO, people followed with great enthusiasm. At the earlier conferences, people followed, but there was no real energy there. It was simply acquiescence and a lack of surprise and an agreement, a basic kind of agreement. But when we announced that the WTO was disbanding, the audience was authentically thrilled and very energetically excited about it. So it just shows that if the right solution did come along and we were somehow able to disband the WTO, there would be a lot of people, and not just the people we expect, who would be very excited about it.
Do you feel the hoax is a legitimate way to create more articles and attention for an important issue?
Well, it is if there's no other way. I mean, it would be great if journalists actually wrote about important issues simply because they're terribly important, like the WTO or the Bhopal situation, but you know, given that many of Bhopal's anniversaries went completely unnoticed in the U.S. media, it seems like it's your only choice.
you talk about identity correction on your website.
Yeah, identity correction is basically adopting the identity of a powerful criminal in order to communicate what that criminal is really about. It's like identity theft, except that identity theft is just about taking someone's money. Identity correction is about correcting a powerful criminal's identity and communicating what they're really about.
So when there's some confusion on the web, you get one of these things. You folks head to the thrift stores for new suits. Is that thrift store trip an important part of your approach?
It is. I mean, we for one thing, you can get a perfectly good suit in a thrift store. We don't always go to the thrift store because, of course, we keep the suits, and so sometimes we don't have to go get a new one. But there's absolutely no reason to buy a new suit. And one important thing for us is to communicate that it's easy to do this sort of thing. You don't have to necessarily have a website or be invited in the way that we've been invited. There's plenty of ways to correct identity. And you can, yeah, there are lots of people doing it, have done it for a long time. And we're going to be writing about that more in our new book. We've got a book about the WTO stuff that's just come out called The Yes Men. And it has some material about other things, mostly just about our own WTO stunts.
And where is that available?
You can find it on our website at theyesmen.org.
Very good. Now, the work that you're doing here, would you say that this is a political strategy as opposed to just a game? I mean, did you guys sit around and talk about various strategies you might employ and then arrive
sure.
at this?
If we had legal training, we'd maybe be lawyers. If we were of a political bent, we would maybe be politicians. We go to protests, and we protest on the ground, and we write polemics and so on. The sort of things we do where we impersonate organizations, represent organizations, we think of as just another protest technique, basically, one of many. And insofar as it's effective, that's great. Mm-hmm. It's not a replacement for anything else. It's just another technique, and it's an old one that's been around for a very long time. The Yippies in the 60s did things that very similar to what we're doing, and people have throughout the decades done this sort of thing.
Were you politically active before you started the Yes Men?
Yeah, we both were. Not as much, but we definitely went to protests and were very concerned about certain issues and did it in a more traditional way.
Are there other major issues besides WTO and Bhopal that are on your radar?
Well, right now we're just kind of recovering from our Bhopal experience, our little stunt there, and trying to figure out the next step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're definitely writing a new book, and besides that, we're going to wait and see.
Yeah. Have you seen copycat Yes Men yet?
Well, there are a lot of other people doing this sort of thing. I don't think they're copycats. I think it's kind of an idea that maybe came to a lot of people at once. And the idea of impersonating people. There's a couple of Danes who went around the United States over the election, over the couple months before the election, posing as Danes for Bush. And people were so thrilled to meet Danish people who were for Bush that they got all kinds of access to all kinds of really interesting people. They've made a TV program in Denmark about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You and Mike sit around and cook up ideas, or how do these ideas happen?
Well, sometimes we do. Sometimes we come up with ideas. More often the ideas find us. Like we'll get invitations or people suggest things or that sort of thing. With the election, we cooked up the idea of going around the country posing as the Bush campaign. And you can see the whole story of that on our website. But generally, we've waited for things to come into the website and then figured out, to one or another website that we've set up, and then figured out what we wanted to do with it.
Mm-hmm. How do you guys come to political activism? Do you do the, in other words, were your families active politically? Was this...
No. I mean, we both, both our families are leftists. Mm-hmm. But strangely, we discovered that both of our grandparents died in the Holocaust, which is interesting. And I think for both of us, we've always been aware of just how bad power can get and have always had a very questioning attitude, I guess you could say, towards government and other forms of power because of that. Perhaps because of that, but of course there are plenty of people who have a lot of political awareness without that. So,
Why Paris, France?
Oh, I just moved to Paris during the dot-com boom. Most of my friends were evicted in San Francisco because of the uncontrolled market for apartments there. They just found themselves evicted one after the other. 90% of the nonprofits were evicted, and it just became unlivable because of a complete lack of regulation of what was happening. So I just picked up and left, and I speak French. I'd been here before, and had always dreamt of living here, so I just risked it and moved here, got a job, moved here.
Huh. What kind of work do you do there now?
Well, right now, the last couple of years, I've just been full-time occupied with the Yes Men thing. But I've done computer programming in the past.
Any hints about the future of the Yes Men? Where you may focus, who you may target? You probably can't say much.
Well, it's all impromptu.
And as you said, you may not know yet yourselves.
Yeah. Well, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're working on it. You know, new things come in, new ideas come in, people write in new ideas. We've got some ideas of our own where we'd like to focus. And, you know, our movie's coming out in Europe right now, so we're taken up with a lot of promotion.
Will that be the initial release of the movie, or has it been
released? No, it came out in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The DVD's coming out in February, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S. The movie's being released in Europe, though, now.
Are you in distribution in the U.S.?
It was in theaters in October and November.
Okay.
It might still be in a few theaters now, but it's mostly over in the U.S., though it could come back, I suppose. But meanwhile, while you're waiting for the DVD, there's always the book.
Uh-huh, that's true.
Four-color book makes a good Christmas gift.
I noticed that the book's proceeds go to CAE, the Critical Art Ensemble Defense Fund.
Yeah, if you get it from our website and you pay a little more for signed copies, then all the profits go to the Critical Art Ensemble Defense Fund. And this is this horrific case where a friend of ours, Steve Kurtz of the Critical Art Ensemble, has found himself in this totally Orwellian situation where he's been accused of bioterrorism. It's a very long story and a very ugly one and an amazing one.
Because of his art?
Well, it's just an incredibly awful situation, and people should visit the caedefensefund.org to get lots of information about that and find out how you can help, because he's been really targeted by the government in New York for it's unclear why exactly, but it's put him through hell, and he's got an enormous legal bill that he's going to have to pay.
Mm.
And
Any fear of that for yourselves, either legal bills or being called terrorists by U.S. Patriot Act agencies?
We haven't encountered that yet, no. The Harvard Journal of Legislation wrote an article a few years ago talking about possible legislation that would prevent the sort of things that we're doing, but we haven't actually encountered anything recently.
The website, I noticed, had a surprising book review, that of President George W. Bush. I didn't know that he reviewed books or even read them, but apparently so. According to the site, Mr. Bush says, and I quote, "This guy's just a garbage man. There ought to be limits to freedom. Of course, I don't appreciate it, and you wouldn't either." Unquote.
Right.
That's, yeah. So that's, well, high praise indeed for your book.
Yeah, it's really, it was quite generous of him. Got quite a lot of mileage out of that quote, I must say. Fortunately, he didn't have to read the book to make that comment, and he made it actually a few years before the book was written. But he did make it about something we had done, which was the gwbush.com website, mm-hmm. Which, similar to the other websites, we set up a website at gwbush.com, obvious target, and we didn't get invited to any conferences or anything, but he his legal team reacted very heavy-handedly. This was before the 2000 election. They wrote a cease and desist letter. They complained to the Federal Elections Commission that we should be a PAC, a political action committee. And finally, a reporter asked about it, because all this time, of course, everything they did, we sent out a press release bragging about how much they were doing. And a reporter asked him about it, and that's when he made that quote and said there ought to be limits to freedom. If only more people had listened to that carefully.
Well, I appreciate the time you've taken with me here. This is
sure.
Really great. Hope to talk with you another time.
Okay, thanks. Good talking to you, Jerry.
You've been listening to a December 13th, 2004 interview with Andy Bickelbaum by phone from Paris, France. Andy is a member of the Yes Men, a group of political activists who are intent on changing the world one prank at a time. You can find the Yes Men on the web at theyesmen.org. American Dream Radio takes no pleasure in any embarrassment caused to the BBC, which is likely a more credible news organization than almost any of the large corporate-sponsored and corporate-controlled news sources in the U.S. Any embarrassment to some of the other organizations named in this broadcast is another matter. I'm Jerry Krantman, and this is American Dream Radio, on the web at americandreamradio.org.